This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks to better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. Now, we have generally kept to the social sciences and the humanities, but on occasion, we have strayed into the natural sciences. And to help us continue that straying, is Lau Yahua. You've heard him before. He's an ecologist and has a PhD in entomology. I mean, he's of course also an intern at BFM. And we're going to be talking about one element of the evolutionary game, and that involves parents and offspring, and offspring, parent, 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 all kinds of interesting dynamics that go to the heart of the way in which species develop. So, Yahua, what's the starting point of this, and why is it significant for understanding human beings and even human society?
Well, human society, if you try to leave that till the very end, even to follow a logical order. All right, I think we can start by thinking, when we see a mother caring for a baby in her arms, that's like the classical picture, right, we have of like, oh, love, sacrifice, that kind of and then we tend to describe a baby as a bundle of joy. Now, so what we're going to talk about today is whether a baby is indeed, a bundle of joy. Does it deserve that description?
I thought it was baby was some screaming creature with a nappy full of something else.
You are not the mother, that's why.
Well, okay, let's confess here. Any of us here mothers?
Let me check, no.
Any of us fathers?
No, not yet.
And I was told before the show that my two cats do not count as surrogate children.
No.
Because
they don't have your genes.
They don't have my genes.
But they do have your DNA at some point, in some way.
How do they have my DNA?
When you hug them and cuddle them and kiss them?
Yeah.
Anyway, go on. Yeah.
Mingling of hairs has your DNA.
Co-mingling of hairs?
Yeah.
And fluids? No, I don't think so.
All right. Okay, let's go back to the loving picture of a mom and her baby. Right. So, the classical view is that parents, say a mother and her child, have perfectly aligned interest. Right. Interest in this sense in that... Well, we go back to fitness. No, the child has his mom's genes, and the mom would require the child to survive and reproduce to carry on her copies of genes. So the classical view is that their interests are aligned, so they should work together. Until we realize that each child only carries half of the mom's genes, and so for the mom, she would want to have as many offspring or as many children as she can, to increase the number of genes and increase her fitness. But for the child, it is related most to itself, right? So its interest is not perfectly aligned with his mother, right? He wants to have everything for himself, if possible. Let's think milk bottles, for example. If you want to picture that, say a mom has only 10 milk bottles in her whole lifetime, right? And then she'll need to say feed the milk bottles to her children. If each child requires only one milk bottle to survive, then a mom should have 10 children and then give each child one milk bottle. But for the child, that's not what it wants. It's not satisfied with just one milk bottle. It wants 2, 3, 4, if possible. Then that's the conflict they were talking about here.
Right. So the mother wants her genes to carry on in the child, but the child wants its own genes to carry on in surviving and in reproducing. And those two sets of genes are actually quite different genes, right? Because one, for the child, it's a combination of mum's and dad's genes, whereas for the mum, it's just her genes.
Well, for the mum, the child carries only half her genes, right? And so she will need to have as many children as possible to have more copies of her genes in the population. That's what we call fitness. For the child, if it has a sibling, right, if the mom has another child, and that's a full sibling, then that sibling will have another half of his genes. It's not as good as I get all the benefits for myself, because I'm serving my own genes 100%.
So if I'm following you correctly, Yao Hua, what you're saying is that by default, what's happening to the mother-child is really an antagonistic process,
yep,
whereby their interests have to always be aligned.
Yeah.
Because biologically, mm-hmm, physiologically, they're drawn to different needs or the different, yep, interests, as you put,
yep,
it.
Yep.
Is this a specifically human thing, or is this something that we can observe broader among other animals too? Maybe that context can show just sort of how natural, quote unquote, that is.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely not unique to humans. Mm-hmm. Although in mammals, the milk, the mammalian gland, that's quite specific. You find this conflict in any species where the female is polygamous, which means that it mates with more than one male, right? And reproduction is sexual.
Uh-huh.
If it's asexual reproduction, just fully cloning each other, then the mother and the clone, the offspring, are like identical. Then there's no conflict of interest there because they share the exact same genes.
I see.
Okay. Yeah. You know, when you said there was an antagonism between child and mother, for clarification, it seems like the child would be in conflict with other siblings rather than the mother, because they have a relationship of one where they are soliciting from the mother all kinds of things against other siblings who are doing the same thing. So they all have a relationship to the mother of dependency and such, but the antagonism is really with each other. In that generation, is that correct?
Yes, correct. Although we are seeing that, there's nowhere a very joyful environment, mm-hmm, in a family.
So it's multi-layered antagonism.
Yes, for the mother, she wants as many offspring as possible, right? But among the offspring, they are competing against each other, especially if they don't share the same father.
Okay, but how does the mother say, we're talking about a mother bird and it was giving of worms rather than bottles of milk. Okay. I mean, how does the mother tell the difference between these offspring? I mean, if paternity is an issue, I mean, how does that figure?
Well, for the mother in her own nest, say she has a nest, right? She should be able to tell that, well, in most cases, all these are her own offspring. And in that case, she probably doesn't care. Well, if let's take a very simple scenario. She does not need to differentiate between the father of each of these offspring, because each of these children will carry half of her genes. And so for her, it doesn't matter. But it matters for the dad a lot. It matters for the dad a lot, and it certainly matters for each child, because each child wants the full attention of the mother to give it the most that she can give.
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but every time I see pictures of, you know, a little birdlings, if that's, mm-hmm, a technical term for them.
Nestlings.
Yeah. They just look alike. I mean, how does the mother bird tell the difference? And what would baby bird say to mother to attract attention to itself? I mean, why would you get half a worm more than the other birdling nestlings?
You mean how could they do it?
Yeah, I mean, how would they get the mother to give them more?
Well, how does any human child get more from the parent?
Kicking and screaming,
getting attention. It's sort of like blackmailing. It's a war of attrition. You know, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to keep on crying.
Or pout, or sulk.
Yeah.
To a tantrum. But then presumably all of them are going to be doing the same thing. I mean, I can imagine maybe some of the children maybe are deformed or have some sort of, you know, something that makes the mother think, okay, not worth investing in this one because it's not, mm-hmm, going to survive, right? Mm-hmm. But the others, you know, everything else being equal, they're all equally likely to survive. How would each of them attract the mother to give them more?
But they cannot be all equal, mm-hmm, because they're not the same. If they're all the same, then they'll be clones of each other. So they're not the same right from the very start. So some would be, you know, some would say be stronger, some would digest faster and get hungrier faster. So begging, since we're talking about birds, right? Begging is a characteristic of nestlings. You know, they'll cry to their mom. Whenever the mom returns with food, then they'll start crying to their mom. I can't imitate the sound, but they're gonna, you know, make the sound that they do. We call it begging.
Chirp, chirp. I think
chirp, tweet. Yeah.
No, that won't get you any food at all. That's too weak. Yeah.
I would have died in the nest.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't rehearsed my tweeting in a while. Yeah. But go on. Yeah.
You don't tweet. That's the problem. I do.
Yeah.
And my handle is. Oh, sorry. That's too early in the show to say that.
Okay. Yeah. You have to do a lot. better than that.
You said that this is characteristic among mammals, female mammals who are polygamous.
Among all animals, they are polygamous.
But we have somehow told ourselves as human beings that women, by and large, aren't polygamous.
Perhaps only in the past few centuries. It's not. It's not that much. Yeah, I don't think we have remained monogamous for that long.
Well, my great grandmother had four husbands, so I can tell you that. It wasn't very long ago that humans of the species. Women of our species have been polygamous.
And what I find interesting is the narratives and the stories we tell ourselves about, you know, family and monogamy that really diverges from the things you describe.
Right? Okay, so maybe we stick to non-human animals first, because there's always the question of culture that intervenes when we talk about human beings and the power of culture to shape behavior. But what the story you're telling is eventually about behavior, isn't it? It isn't simply about some sort of automatic transmission. I mean, we're not just interested in that. We're also interested in how it shapes the behavior of individual animals, right?
Yeah. So actually, it spans a full range from very basic physiological processes in the womb all the way up to behaviors that we see in babies. You know, why is it so hard to wean a baby? Well, again, none of us is a mother here, and we are not fathers, but it's actually very challenging to wean a baby, to stop a baby from feeding on breast milk.
Right.
Yeah, and it's very difficult in humans, much more than other apes, non-human apes like chimpanzee. And I don't mind talking about humans, because this is very relevant to how human development, how human life history has evolved.
But are we not just being genetically deterministic in the sense that even children have varying personalities?
Yes.
Right? Are they all necessarily by default competitive and always sensitive to threats and scarcity? I mean, is there...
You know, I mean, the question maybe is, we use words like competition and competitiveness. We must separate the kind of value judgment that we project onto the word of competitiveness, right? And maybe
just the kind of fun what you describe, that there is this idea of scarcity and that what we have to do to kind of survive is to beg and scream. I mean, that's competition, right?
Yeah. Definitely we have to compete to get limited resources, each of us. Otherwise, we wouldn't survive.
But how do we know that there's like limitation? How does an infant know that it's limited?
Animals with 10. Animals always reproduce more than they expect to survive. That's just how it works. If you only reproduce just enough that you think they will all survive, it doesn't happen that way. You know, chaos, you know, a lot of chaos. Things always happen. You know, bad things always happen. So you always reproduce more than you expect them to survive. And there's always a limited... resources are always limiting. So how do the infant know? Well, they have been selected to live in such an environment. Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption to make. Yeah.
You know, there's very interesting moments in literature, movies or whatever, when you have these questions of parents and choices. If you remember, Sophie's Choice revolved around the central character who had to choose between her boy child and her girl child in a situation where a Nazi officer had demanded a child. And she gave away her girl child. And it's very interesting. I don't think anybody's ever thought about what it meant. Why is it that she gave away her girl child instead of her boy child? You know, and I, you know, and it's an interesting question.
Well, right off the top of my mind, I can, if she knows that the future population, the next generation, will be mostly female, she should give away her daughter, because her one son then will be a limiting resource, and he will then go on to mate with many of these.
Well, there women. You have it. Yeah. Sophie's Choice explained.
Evolutionarily.
Yeah, I haven't read the book. I think it's a book, right? Yeah,
and a movie.
I do want to get back to Sharad's point earlier about how when we are, this is a meta theory question, but how when we observe natural phenomena, how do we know we're not? I mean, there is this realist objectivity that we can discern, and how we know we're not just imposing sort of the values that's around the discourse, like competition, right? I mean, now we're in the age of competition, essentially. And this, interestingly, is seamless with the kind of narrative that you're presenting. How do we know that it really is objective natural world, or we're just carrying our biases into it.
I think it would be very naive to say that all our hypotheses and all our, you know, it's like pure, it's like purely objective. I don't think we can make that assertion. But we try to be as objective as possible, and then from there we come up with predictions across the board. And then you apply that prediction to all the systems, right? And the systems are very different. You know, the ape system, the way they have evolved is very different from, say, insects and from plants. But if you put that your principle, your hypothesis across all the systems and the predictions match, then I think it's fair to say that, hey, yes, objective, it's rational, logical, and hopefully true. Yeah.
Well, you know, up next we continue our discussion about the evolutionary game and its implications for all life on planet Earth, including human life. You've been listening to Lau Ya Hua. He's an ecologist and has a PhD in entomology. And of course, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman, myself, Sharad Kutad. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and Night School continues with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and Lau Ya Hua. He's an ecologist and has a PhD in entomology, so which means he, you know, studies insects. But today, he's not talking about insects in particular. He's talking about all human and non-human life and evolutionary biology and, you know, what you call the evolutionary game. Mm-hmm. We ended off with a discussion of whether we were imposing human values or frameworks on the dynamic set in non-human societies. The word competition in particular came up for some sort of discussion earlier. Where do we go from now in trying to understand this evolutionary game?
Yeah, I think Fuad picked on a very good point. Like, we are asserting our own views onto the natural system. I think that was what we did before when we looked at a mother, you know, loving her child and say, oh, that's such a sweet relationship. And until sometime in the 60s, when ecologists and evolutionary biologists, they came out with this thing called the kin selection. And, well, anyway, they imposed evolutionary biology to analyze relationships. Then they found all sorts of conflict between kin, right? Between two individuals that are related, either fully related, they'll be clones, or they are related by half, that means, you know, between parent and offspring or full siblings. And then sometime in the 80s, the professor, well, he was a graduate student then, David Hague, he imposed this onto parent-offspring. And then he went one step further.
Parent-offspring of humans or just all types of animals?
He did it on humans. He used it on humans, right? And that was what we talked about in the first half, right, previously. But David Hague, he went one step further, and he used the predictions about, he used the whole theory of parent-offspring conflict, right? And he disregarded all this loving relationship, and he came up with the prediction that if all these conflicts exist, then in a single child, the genes from the mother should be conflicting with the genes from the father too, right? And that mechanism, that could serve as a mechanism to explain the conflict that we see between the mother and the child. Okay.
But how do you disentangle the genetic endowments of father and mother? I mean, does the child discern it? Does the mother discern it? What is it?
Yeah, so the way it works is, okay, well, we know we are all diploid animals, right? So we carry one set of genes from our father and one set of genes from our mother. And in most of the genes, they have two working copies and they work together. But in some genes, scientists found out that if they are carried in the sperm, those genes, these are called imprinted genes, the genes in the sperm are expressed differently than the genes in the egg. So the sperm from a male will carry genes that are activated to benefit the male. And then the gamete, the egg, will carry genes that are activated to benefit the mother. So when the offspring is formed from the meeting of the sperm and the egg, the mother, through her egg, has her genes in there that are activated to benefit the mother.
You give us an example?
Yeah. An example would be, a very common example is the... Okay, this is going to be acronym IGF-2. So it's insulin growing factor 2. All right. So this is a factor that promotes growth. Now, for the mother, a fast-growing baby is actually not so good. It's not good because it would be a very hungry baby. It would devoid her of all her attention and resources. She doesn't want a monster. She doesn't want a monster that grows very fast and is hungry and then it grows big, you know. But for the father, that's what he wants his offspring to be. He wants his offspring to be a big baby, right? And so when this gene is carried through the sperm, it is actively expressed. Okay, it promotes growth in the baby. And if it, when this gene is carried in the egg, so this gene is found in both of it, yeah? When it's carried in the egg, it is silenced. So it's not active. So when so in the resulting offspring, in the child, we have these genes, but the father's side expresses it, whereas the mother's side is silent. And so, but the mother will of course have other genes that sought to that seek to counteract. So in 1%, less than 1% of our genes are like this, and they are the source of a lot of conflict between the parent and the offspring.
How does this framework explain stuff that we know or experience by intuition, like the child's love for the mother's love for the child, that is altruistic in a lot of ways, self-sacrificing and all that? How does that interact with that phenomena?
We don't really accept altruism in biology. It's just you just haven't found the point of conflict. You know, it used to be. I'm going to move away from animals now and use an example that I'm more comfortable with, spiders. Now, there's a species of spiders, but the mother only has one batch of offspring. And when this batch of offspring, her spiderlings hatch, they'll all jump on, well, they don't jump on, I mean, they'll swarm over her, and then they'll feed off her, and she dies, right? So she has only one batch of offspring, and then all her children, regardless of who their fathers were, right, they'll all feed off her and they effectively kill her.
Okay.
Right? So she sacrificed herself, and we say, wow, that's the most loving mother you can ever have. You know, I have not heard of a human mother feeding herself to her children. This spider does it. Why? Is it altruistic? Well, you can say altruistic, but for us, we put evolutionary game analysis onto it, and we say, of course, it benefits her. This is her strategy. She can only have one batch of offspring, and it doesn't benefit her anymore to live longer than that. So she might as well disperse all her resources for this offspring, for her children. And so, do we call that altruistic?
But that's an inference or phenomena, though. You cannot test that, right? That claim that, of course, this is what she would do in a self-interest.
I wonder, you know, if we're looking at, when we look at different species, we're looking at different strategies. So different species elect over time certain types of strategies to win the genetic game, and the genetic game is passing on your genetic material. But presumably there's more than one strategy, depending on the circumstance, mm-hmm. right? Yep. And we know that different types of reproductive systems, sexual, non-sexual, mm-hmm. have their trade-offs, right?
Yep, yep.
And in fact, the whole idea of having sexual reproduction, you know, either becomes risky in a particular context, it becomes a very risky game to play, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think the fact that this spider has developed a particular strategy might have to do with context or environment or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. But the what remains true is that the end game is the passing on of genes. Right, yep. And the success of the spider, the fact that the spider is not extinct, but yep. perhaps proof that it's a successful strategy.
Yeah, it survived so far. And so, yeah, well, back to Fuad's point, at least the way evolutionary biologists, we do it, is that we try to analyze and see what are the benefits and trade-offs. Thanks, Sharad, for giving me that word. I forgot that word, trade-offs. Yeah, the benefits and trade-offs are in an interaction. For example, parental care. Why should a parent invest more time in one child instead of, like, you know, abandoning a child and then starting a new family and whatnot? Well, it's very difficult to do experiments on humans. Is probably not ethical anyway. But if we go in and then we analyze the adaptive value for the child and then for the parent, you realize that actually it's not so sacrificial. It's not truly altruistic in the way that the individual is giving more than it should. Sacrificing more than it should. It is what it's actually doing is giving enough just to get back what it should be getting. So that I don't think we'll call that altruistic, right? Yeah, it is a trait. Yeah.
Well, you see, this again comes back to the question of culture. I think with human societies, we have the individual culture is very important.
But I think the more fundamental question is the inference, right? Mm. Because you see the phenomena, right? It's I don't know. I'm wondering generally if, you know, it being a trade-off that's sufficient for its self-interest and it being something more, you know, I don't know, flighty or floaty or something like that. It seems to me it's a fine line in the inference. I don't know. I mean, it's a matter of method that I wonder. Like, but while you can test, you know, basic general claims about trade-offs and stuff like that, the meaning of it seems to me is a bit, it's less determined by experiment.
I wonder, you know, actually. Again, I want to build this whole question of society and culture because of the distinction that has come to be made between genes and memes. The idea that there are things that we pass on that are not genetic but are important to human societies. So the kind of strategies that human societies elect in terms of their kinship systems, you know, and the way in which human societies make a distinction between blood kin, consanguines, and all these ways of permutations that have to do with the importance of, say, labor in human society and who gets to mate and why paternity is a huge issue for human societies. You know, it really, the genetic thing is there, the genetic basis is there for our society. But when we have this overlay of the whole cultural and social imperatives and, again, strategies. I mean, the thing about learning anthropology is you learn that over the course of history, human societies have elected all kinds of strategies, some of them not winning strategies. In fact, you know, human societies have failed because their strategies have produced results that were not intended or wanted. So, yeah, I mean, maybe instead of kind of, I mean, just to kind of appreciate the evolutionary game and what it might mean on its own terms, I think, is what I'm particularly interested in. So where do we go from here?
Well, what I have left is, like, you know, in what aspects of human lives can we witness the consequences of this conflict? We can talk about, you know, what happens in the womb. We can talk about the crying and suckling behavior of a baby, you know. We can even talk about human life history, evolution. Why have we evolved to, well, we have very short birth intervals. So a mother, after she has given birth, it doesn't take her long before she's reproductive again, right? Compared to other primates. But her offspring, her children, remain dependent on her for nutrition for quite a long time. You know, up to like 6-7 years, perhaps much longer than other primates. And all of this, you know, scientists they use the parent offspring conflict to explain it. Yeah,
I think what's also very interesting about human societies, perhaps different from animal societies, is that we have a third generation. Mm-hmm. It's actually crucial to the evolutionary trajectory of the species. So the fact that you have grandparents is also a cultural issue, because what grandparents transmit is not genes directly, but in fact culture. So the existence of three generations in the same time frame has actually been a real push for the evolution of our species. And I don't know how that changes the dynamics, because now you don't have just parents and offsprings, you have grandparents.
Yeah, well, the parent-offspring conflict, you put it in the human evolution, we come to realize, and if you couple that with I think they call it ethno data, like data of ancient human populations. What they found was that humans, you know, an individual human as it grows, it switches from a consumer into a producer. Right, in the early stage, it consumes a lot more than it produces, and then later on, it switches into producing a lot more than it consumes, and that latter period of life actually extends for a long time, much longer than in other animal species. And because of the parent-offspring conflict, where the mother has to provide so much, essentially the baby has won, in a sense. The baby has won because it has blackmailed the mom into, like, it has to provide for the baby for a long time. And what that has led to, well, this is very hypothetical, right? It has led to the evolution of human life history development in the sense that it is cheaper to have a human individual die at the early age. It's just gone.
Yeah.
Okay, this is going to sound very morbid, but one dead baby frees up resources for more babies. So it's very cheap to have one. Should I be saying this?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Cost-wise,
yes, all right. But it's very expensive for an adult to die because one adult less is one less producer to support many children, right? And so if you extend it, then it would select for evolution of a long-living species, even past reproductive phase. Grandmothers, grandfathers.
So the first, so that principle that when a ship is sinking, it's we save the women and children first. That's actually a bad idea. We should save the men first, the men and the adults first.
You have to find an optimum.
You shouldn't emphasize. Although I am a male, but still, you shouldn't emphasize the male if you're talking about the continuation of the population, because the male are not the reproductive units.
Okay, so women, adult women are number one, we should save.
Yes, fertile women, number one.
And what about the children? Should we throw them overboard or not?
Is this a trick question?
No, I'm just working through the logic. I mean, in a situation where you have adult males, adult females, and children, a female or male,
yeah,
or maybe you want to differentiate, who should we save first?
You would save the most productive ones first. Yeah.
So
productive and reproductive.
Okay, yeah. Productive and reproductive. So yeah. Reproductive women, or women at the reproductive age,
yeah,
perhaps slightly younger, not too old, mm-hmm, right? So they can have more children.
Yeah.
And males, some males.
Some males. You don't need many males. Yeah, just
okay,
enough males.
But the lowest in the hierarchy of children. Children are the first to go, is it?
Yeah, okay. Definitely. Especially the youngest children.
Lose them. Okay.
I think we all know that, you know, human beings are different than most animals. I think that it's quite established. I just wonder the extent to which some of the traits that make us stand out really can in any way override or interrupt sort of the so-called natural process, and that, you know, the extent to which it can do that. Because I do know that, you know, ultimately human beings can plan, and one of the things that they do plan is family. And of course, my understanding of what the Darwinian worldview look like is you're looking at species being, you're not looking at Sweden, right? You're looking at, let's look at the larger picture here, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that as we have evolved culturally, one of the things that we think we can overcome is particularly
Our animal nature,
but also in particular this discussion, the idea that family, what animates family ultimately is this desire to copy our genes as much as possible. I mean, how do we understand that kind of the gap?
Yeah, well, definitely the invention of contraception has changed the game a lot, right?
Yeah,
and family planning basically has changed it a lot, and you know. Some of us may really wonder, you know, why are you talking about fitness, increasing numbers of copies of genes? I don't even want more than two children, right?
Exactly.
I'm not buying this. I think I understand. Still, it doesn't fall far from how we look at the evolutionary. You are gauging, the individual is gauging the returns from investing in one child compared to having a lot more child. And when having more children becomes more expensive, then it is not advisable to have more children. You rather invest in 1, 2, 3, and you are sort of investing in quality. And that there is this R and K selection. I won't call it theory. We sort of categorize animals or species into whether they're selected for R or K. K, they are longer living species. R are the rapidly reproducing species, you know, like insects. So perhaps we are shifting more and more towards K. We are already K, but perhaps even more towards that.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, ultimately the discomfort that we feel when we talk about this is the refusal to or denial of how close we are to our animal origins, you know, and the idea that we are hardwired to think and behave and act in ways that are really beyond our ability to kind of control. Because if we're acting from our genes, then there's no question of us taking control in an immediate sense.
But what I do wonder is if those things like altruism and love is in fact a part of the animal kingdom, right? That's I just wonder that. I don't know. Because we don't know what we don't have insight into their thought process. And the inferences we make are safe within testable bounds too. So in a lot of ways, this talk of copying genes is a conservative look at sort of the behavior that animates the animal kingdom. So I just wonder, and I know there's some, I can't remember the names now, but there are some people who are trying to point out. Animal rights activists like to do that, you know, like, oh, look at the mother caring, isn't this, they like to anthropomorphize so that we understand, you know. So I just wonder what are the rooms for interpretation are.
Are you asking if there really is love among animals?
I don't know. I mean, I just wonder if
Is there love between human beings?
If it necessarily precludes, if it necessarily excludes the genetic account.
Well, what I have experienced of love is a very wonderful feeling, and it rewards the individual for feeling that way. I mean, it feels good, and you want to do it more, right? And still, you can explain that evolutionarily, because it's rewarding, your genes are rewarding you for a behavior that they want you to do. We are but vessels of genes. I really don't see myself as anything more than that.
And I think we're going to have to end on that.
I'm okay with it. I think that's a good note to end.
Okay. So before we go, we need some recommendations. Just one book at least, Yahua. You can point us in. And in fact, we've had responses to your last show. Somebody's, I think, interested to devote their lives to evolutionary biology.
Good
because
choice.
Of you.
Good
because
choice.
Of you. This might just deepen their commitment. Who knows? You might be reproducing these evolutionary biologists at a rapid rate.
They might wonder why, despite your passion for evolution, you ended up in BFM, though. So somebody No, I'm not. I'm just asking. I'm curious, too. Maybe another episode.
Yeah, there are many games to be played in BFM. Yeah. Okay, well, I don't have a book to recommend, but I do have a very good article from... Is that fine? An article?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah?
So it's written by Suzanne Sadadin in Aeon. So it's an online magazine, Aeon as in A-E-O-N. You can just look it up. It's the article is called War in the Womb by Suzanne Sadadin, Aeon.
You know, what kind of popular natural science magazines would you go to if somebody was interested just to kind of keep up with developments in the natural sciences?
Well, I probably wouldn't recommend like a hard copy magazine now. They are free to read magazines. Just go look up PLOS One. PLOS, yeah, PLOS One.
How do you spell that?
PLOS One. Okay. One as in O-N-E, PLOS One.
Fuad, do you want to throw something into the mix?
That's a Peter Singer book, I think it's called The Expanding Circle, that tries to account for altruism within an evolutionary frame. And it's a very conservative notion of altruism, nothing too hokey pokey or anything.
So we're going to have to bring the show to a close. You tweet? Yahua?
Not very actively.
But you have a Twitter handle.
Yeah,
and
it's Yahua Lau.
And I'm at Sharad Kutin. And Fuad would be that starving nestling because he doesn't tweet.
Screen. No, I don't. Not loudly. Not even.
No
silently,
sound.
Yeah.
Sign. So you just your mouth just is open.
I'm not going to survive this.
Yeah, your little tongue wavers, and the worm just misses you every time.
Yeah.
Okay, so mummy's not interested in philosophers.
I better go back and tweet more then.
Yeah, you should tweet all the science stuff out. That'd be fascinating. Thank you so much, Awa, for joining us. And that's all we have for Night School. You can, of course, continue this discussion on our Facebook page, BFM Night School.
And email us, bfmnightschool@gmail.com. We haven't been hearing from you guys, so, you know, keep them coming.
Thank you so much. That's all. You've been listening to Lau Yahua, Ahmad Fuad Ramat, and myself, Sharad Kutin. This has been Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.